C1OB. Chapter 11. Some Objections Answered. The Structure of the Christian Science Textbook. Our Way of Life. Number 1A.
Today we come to the chapter Some Objections Answered. It's the 11th chapter at the point of Christianity as Christianity. If we look back historically and see how this chapter came into the Christian Science textbook, we see that earlier in 1885, this chapter was called Reply to a Clergyman. So it seemed that really this chapter has first been answering the objections that came from the side of theology, and only later on until 1885, the chapter was called Reply to a Clergyman. Then from that time on until 1890, it was called Reply to a Critic. So you can see it was made much more universal and a bit more impersonal, so that these objections have come from various sides, not only from the side of theology, but also from thinkers, from philosophers. And then only since 1891, since the 50th edition, this chapter is called Some Objections Answered. And I think the most important point to know right away is that this chapter actually is not written for the outsider, but also for the student of Christian Science himself, that it is not just answering critics from theology that come from the side of theology or the philosophers, but that they are actually objections that are lingering within the mentality of each student of Christian Science, and therefore that we have to give full attention to this chapter, because it will analyze within our consciousness where we make mistakes and what objections are lingering in our consciousness that have to be set aright. As we have seen yesterday, the platform would have shown us really the purity of Christianity, shown us that everything is at the point of pure reflection, and pure reflection is actually demonstration. But then we would say, but why don't I experience this pure reflection as demonstration? And the answer usually is because we are not taking that standpoint of pure reflection wholly. Meaning, really, that there are always some unscientific reasonings and attitudes within ourselves that prevent demonstration, so that the theory can become practical. And therefore, we must see what these objections are that we entertain in consciousness. That's the purpose of this chapter. And I think the best way to introduce the whole tonality of this chapter is if we take the introductory paragraph of the chapter and read it together, because it seems that within a few lines, really, we find everything that needs to be taken into consideration. So we take first the first paragraph and then afterwards the scriptural note. And I read to you this first paragraph. So she speaks about the strictures on this volume. We can right away see it has to do with strictures, with critics, the criticism. And all through this chapter flow the tone of strictures, criticism, the critics, that's mentioned about 8 times, about the denunciation, objections, misrepresentation of facts, and you can see it deals with that sense, how can we answer these objections and critics. It is a critics on this volume. It's quite interesting that she doesn't say it's a critics against her theology that she has presented. She naturally has presented a different theology than the church theology. So it isn't so much that she is here criticized for having a different kind of God or a different concept of man or the universe or so. But it's mostly directed against the textbook itself, how she has written the textbook and presented the subject. So the stricture on this volume would condemn to oblivion the truth, small t, the truth, which is raising up thousands from helplessness to strength. Just as far as that, we can see the critics are against what? That she was able to prove her theory. That she was able to prove her theory by works, by showing that she could raise up thousands from helplessness to strength. And one can see it is therefore showing that the objections are against a practical Christianity, which she afterwards states, and elevating them from a theoretical to a practical Christianity. So the main point of this chapter would therefore have to show what are the objections that are brought forward, because it is objected that truth is practical, that the true theory of Christianity is actually practical and can be proved in a practical way. So this is the main point I think we'll find here. Then she gives a reason why these objections and criticism are brought forward. And the reason is in the next sentences. These criticisms are generally based on detached sentences or clauses separated from their context. So you see, what she is telling is that actually these criticisms are not so much criticizing her theology, her concept of God, man, and the universe, but much more are they criticizing her because the reader takes a false method of reading and interpretation, that the reader takes detached sentences and considers detached sentences or clauses separately out of context, and that would really lead to misunderstanding. Think of the depth of what she says here. The depth that she says that whenever we study the textbook so that we detach single sentences or paragraphs from the context, that then we are really on the wrong track. And that then we have a proposition or a starting point which can never really lead to a real conclusion. But if we read sentences detached from the chapter, detached from the whole presentation of the textbook, that the danger is that we misinterpret these sentences. Here you have a terrific sense of what we were discussing in earlier years, namely that a truth is not always a scientific truth. That if we feel that we are reading a truth or stating a truth, that this does not yet amount to be a scientific truth. A truth, a detached statement that is true by itself, can be misinterpreted when it should be when it is used to interpret the whole. Therefore, only then, when a single statement, a single truth, is understood in its whole, therefore in its place within the whole, only then can that single sentence be interpreted the right way. And this is the reason why so many students read the textbook for 10, 20, 30, 40 more years and actually seldom really find the answer to the whole textbook. They seem to be unable really to relate single sentences to the whole and therefore find right conclusions. Naturally, you can see that this stems mainly from the lesson sermons. They are written that way and presented that way. They are detached sentences out of context and are presented to the student to read them. And it is exactly that what Mrs. Eddy says a student of Christian Science should not do. That leads really to misinterpretation. You could naturally say, but Mrs. Eddy instituted the lesson sermons. Yes, she did. But not yesterday, and not today, but 100 years ago, at a time where she knew that the whole field was in a stage of a nursery school, where she could see that practically nobody of her students could understand what she was teaching, and therefore she had to do with the teaching the same as she had to do with healing. She had to reduce it to the mentality of the age, just as she has shown at her time that no student could really understand the healing method that she was presenting, namely the healing method of science, and therefore she said she had to reduce it to the method of argumentation, which is no more science, which is just blunt metaphysics, but no more science. And in the same way, she could see that the time was not right at her time to teach science as a science, and therefore she had to make the best of it and reduce it to studying atomistically. Here a sentence, there a sentence, out of context. Now we know that Mrs. Eddy knew that she was giving with the manual laws of limitations, and that she was not giving in the manual what she is giving in the textbook, the laws of the infinite one that has no limitations. So it is our mistake to take a method that was adapted to an age that is 100 years past and take the method of yesterday for the study of the textbook of today. That's why she has made provisions in the deed of trust that the lesson sermons can be changed, the format and the subject can be changed, but they have never been changed because nobody would know what to do now, because nobody knows how to teach science as a consistent, coherent teaching. And this is what she says right afterwards. Even the scripts, even means next to the textbook. Just as with the textbook, even the scriptures, which grow in beauty and consistency from one grand root, appear contradictory when subject to such usage. Therefore, the Bible and the textbook will never be understood as what they teach if they are not studied and understood as stemming out of one great root. Therefore, where we see that every leaf of the tree is fundamentally dependent on the root of the tree, out of one root, out of one stem, can be seen and deduced through its infinite categories up to the least detail. If we take the leaf away from the root, it will fade, it will die. Just as the teaching of the textbook, if we take only single sentences and contemplate single sentences as if they would be able to stand alone, that teaching is dying. And you know it is dying. Here, Mrs. Eddy has given in the textbook the science and not the ecclesiastical approach like in the manual. In the textbook, we have the laws of unlimited being, of the infinite, whereas the manual gives us, all through the manual, the laws of limitation. That's why the manual contradicts outwardly so much with the textbook. The textbook shows that we have one grand root, that we are governed by one principle, that everyone has the direct approach to principle and should accept no other authority and government but the one divine principle. Whereas the manual puts restriction on the individual, the laws of limitation, and says there are five people in Boston that will tell you what you are allowed to read, what you are allowed to say, what you are allowed to write, what you are allowed to think. Absolutely in opposition to her statement in the textbook. She knew that in the nursing state, in the kindergarten state, you have to give to children another teaching than if you are grown up. Therefore, the textbook is written for the thinker. The time for thinkers has come. The textbook is not written for the churchy-minded student. That you can see that very easily, that when you read, for instance, the preface of the textbook, and where she comes at the end of the preface to her biography, where she gives her biography, stating what she has been doing every year, you will notice that she only gives the biography as a teacher, never as a religious person, never as a church founder, because she only speaks about the biography of the teaching of her science. When she has founded the first class, and who she was teaching, how many she was teaching, how she has founded the Metaphysical College, she did not say that she has founded a church in the textbook. Nothing of that is in it. She could have said that the same way as she gives the dates and of what she founded as in the teaching line, she could have said, and I also founded the first church organization, and then I dissolved it, and then I founded the second church organization. Not a word in it, because church has no place in science. And the textbook is therefore for the student of a science, and a student of a science, if he wants to learn its subject, certainly does not go to church and sing hymns. He has to understand the subject, and he has to be alone with God and the reality of his being in order to find his unity with God and to understand the subject. So in some objections answer, you really find that Mrs. Eddy would say that both the scripture and the textbook must be studied and seen from the one root. And only if we are thinking out from the one root, from the one principle, and deduce from the one principle, that only then her teaching is consistent. Else her teaching is inconsistent. Showing again that the same statement can be a statement of consistency, a scientific truth, and the same statement can be contradictory. And this is what we have to see, that only as we take the textbook as presenting a holistic sense of being. A holistic sense of being means to show always being as a whole and not as some total of a lot of atomistic statements, of atomistic truth. Only then really can we understand the textbook, and only then the statements in the textbook are no more contradictory. So this is the great point here in that whole chapter, that he has to show that only if we consider always every statement in relationship to all what has been said in the textbook, to the whole of the textbook, that the statement makes sense. You know how many of the statements seem to be contradictory. That Mrs. Eddy would say that God does not know no disease, and on the other hand, that God heals disease. Just to take one example. So either God knows no disease, then he has not to heal any disease, or if God heals disease, the reasoning is, well, then he has to know disease. So from the human point, these statements are contradictory. They only resolve themselves when we put this statement into the right place within the whole system of Christian Science. If we put them into the right category and levels and see that these statements are statements that go out from very different standpoints, and that every standpoint has its right within the whole system. So Jesus said, that's the end of the paragraph, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God truth." It's a great appeal to be pure in heart. What does pure in heart mean? Naturally, as long as statements are contradictory, they are never pure. They contradict, there is a friction in it, and an argumentation starts. Pure is when every statement is reflecting every other statement without any contradiction. If every statement is a pure reflection of the whole, and only then when nothing impure, nothing contradictory is within our consciousness, then we have a pure heart. Then that pure heart, that purity of reflection, is that which elevates theoretical Christianity to practical Christianity. Which she brings out by saying, really, that if we have a pure reflection in our heart, that is demonstration. That pure reflection is demonstration. The moment we have a pure reflection in our consciousness, that's the point where demonstration takes place. Yes. So let's consider these main points in the introductory paragraph again, and just see how she deals with it, first in a general way, all through the chapter. so as to see that in this introductory paragraph she has really set the tone for the whole chapter. I have asked her various questions in the study material under that introductory paragraph, and I just run through it quickly. So, how can a theoretical Christianity be elevated to a practical Christianity is the great question, and we see that we can only do that if we do not detach sentences and clauses from the context, or else that the text will seem contradictory. Now, is it necessary, therefore, to understand truth which is free from contradiction? Yes, her great subject here is really consistency and coherency, two terms which she only uses in this chapter, in no other chapter. What does mean consistency? The Webster says that very clearly. Consistency means coherence. It means union. Can you see union? You will see that consistency has always to do that every statement has to be united with the whole. Union. Hence, that which stands together as a united whole. So, statements, single sentences, single paragraphs have to be considered as standing together in a united whole. Always to see what is its place value within a bigger frame of reference. Instead of analyzing a sentence, we should do the very opposite. Integrate it into the bigger context. And only then, when we do that, we find the true answer. Consistency is also defined as condition of standing or adhering together, or being fixed in union. You have again fixed in union. A degree of resistance to separation of constituent particles. It's resistance to separation, so that we are not detaching a truth from the whole of truth. It also is defined as agreement or harmony of parts, that parts work together in harmony, in true relation, no friction, no irritation, and that means that each part nicely fits together with every other part. Can you see again what I said before? Instead of analyzing a sentence into its parts, we should take a sentence and see how is it united to the bigger whole. How is it a statement within the bigger frame of reference, within a paragraph, the paragraph within a part, the part within a chapter, the chapter within the textbook. And only in this way we really begin to be able to interpret a single truth so that it is a scientific truth.